All's Well That Ends Well is the second National Theatre production chosen to be broadcast live to some 280 cinemas in the UK and around the world. After the success of the first NT live experiment with Racine's Phèdre in June, this exuberant Olivier production, with its larger cast, different locations and complicated fairy tale design, presents a different challenge. The director of All's Well, Marianne Elliott, is with me, Heather Neal, now at the NT, where this rarely seen tragicomedy continues to delight audiences, with Michelle Terry in the role of Helena, Claire Higgins as the Countess, and Conleth Hill as the boastful Parolles. Well, Marianne Elliott has had successes at the National before, notably War Horse as a co-director, Pillars of the Community, St Joan, all of which were award-winning productions, and among work elsewhere, a very funny Much Ado About Nothing for the RSC. And we better say just something about the plot of All's Well, as it's not the best-known Shakespeare play. It concerns a clever physician's daughter called Helena, who falls in love with snobbish Bertram, the son of the Countess of Rossillon. And after curing the King of France of a fistula, Helena is awarded Bertram's hand as a sort of prize in marriage. But he absconds after the wedding, and she only wins him back by following him to war in Florence and tricking him into bed. Oh, and there's a subplot. A swaggering, boastful Parolles, who is Bertram's companion, is taught a lesson by the other French soldiers. Well, Marianne, this used to be categorised, along with other plays written at about the same time in the early 1600s, Troilus and Cressida and Measure for Measure and a couple of others, as a problem play. That's considered a rather old-fashioned label now, but this is a play full of problems, isn't it? Not least, why on earth does talented, resourceful Helena want to marry callow Bertram? And I wondered if your enthusiastic embracing of the play's fairy tale elements went some way to finding a solution to the many problems in this play.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is a problematic play, but that doesn't make it less interesting, I don't think. I was hugely attracted to the story of it when I read it recently, and I was trying to find a Shakespeare to do in this slot. And out of all the Shakespeares, I thought it was the most alluring at the moment for me, because it's a brilliant storyline, and it's a storyline which we're familiar with people that we know around us all the time. I mean, I'm well used to seeing girls going after boys or women going after men, and men do it too, but I think girls are particularly good at it. And these men are just never going to be interested. And you think, why are you even bothering? You're so fascinating. You've got some wonderful aspects about yourself. You're incredibly attractive. Why channel all that energy into one person who's never going to see you in the way you want them to see you? So I thought it was a very modern story. The idea of setting it in a fairy tale, sort of folk tale world, sort of grim folk tale, dark folk tale, was because it felt like Shakespeare had taken a more or less conventional folk tale structure and twisted it into something that was much more complicated than that. So he's sort of taking stereotypes and then fleshing them out and giving them desires and objectivities and motivations that don't quite fit that fairy tale structure. So just as we get older in life and we've been fed these fairy tales as kids, you get to a point, or certainly I did, where I started to think, but what happens if I don't get to happy ever after? And what happens if I do get to happy ever after? What happens after that? It's much more complicated than that. So he's sort of giving us a very familiar story and then constantly changing it, making it go in different directions, fleshing it out, as I say, making it three-dimensional in order to say why life is so much more complex than that and therefore kind of much more fruitful in a way.
So was there any difficulty in keeping the psychological truth of the characters while at the same time going in for references to fairy and folktale? Because we have quite specific ones, don't we? We've got a Red Riding Hood, and we've got a pair of slippers that might remind us of Cinderella, and there's a sort of effect of Sleeping Beauty about the castle as well. Mm. So was it difficult to keep those two things going simultaneously?
No, because I think it's there in the writing. I think in the writing he sets up a story where somebody cures the king, and that somebody therefore then has a various is set various tasks, which they achieve. And at the end of that achievement, they are meant to get married to whoever they choose. It just so happens that he reverses it and makes it a female, yet that female is the protagonist, and the male doesn't want to get married to the female, and it's a man's world.
Yes.
So,
yes, I've always wanted the woman to not to say yes in stories like
yeah,
that.
Exactly,
the other
exactly.
way around.
Yeah. Exactly, and he doesn't say yes. Yeah. And we're not outraged by that. A lot of us aren't outraged by that. A lot of people think, well, that's fair enough. Why should he say yes? It's not his choice. Anyway, the fairy tale structure is there and the shape of it is there, but because it's Shakespeare, he does flesh it out. He does make you think about psychological truth and why does one character do one thing after another. And there are moments, for example, with Bertram's character, who is the man that she's after, where sometimes it was quite hard to know exactly what he felt. Mm. Because he never has a monologue to the audience saying, I'm doing this because I'm feeling like this and that's unfair and therefore I'm going there. Come with me, audience. Mm. He doesn't really do that. He's a very internalised character that feels very entrapped. Everything around him is entrapping him. He thinks that he's going to get away from his entrapping mother when his entrapping father dies. He gets to the king's court. He thinks, great, it's like leaving home for university. I'm going to be a man. I'm going to be like my dad. There's a war on. Fantastic. I can go out and be a military hero. No, the king entraps him and says, you can't go. Everybody else can go, but you can't. Helena turns up. She wants him. She entraps him again by getting married to him. So there are lots of signals to the audience and to the actor playing in the character why he feels so pent up and why he does slightly wild things. Mm. But he never has a moment where he tells us or tells another character on stage that. Mm-hmm. So there are moments where you think, what's going on? But there are signs to help you along the way.
Well, the stage looks absolutely stunning. You've obviously worked very closely with the designer, Ray Smith. You have Rackham-like effects, and you have little silhouette moments, and you have screens, and you have animations of owls and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
I was just wondering how all this is going to be translated into NT Live, because Fedra worked beautifully, but it was one set, and the main changes in what it looked like were to do with lighting. Mm. There's so much to look at here. Is that a problem, that whatever we look at, we're going to be missing a lot of other things?
Yes. I think we just have to be really clever. We've got 9 cameras.
That's more than for Fedra, isn't it?
Fedra had 5.
Yeah.
We can overlay images. We can also take a wide shot, which takes in the whole of the stage. So hopefully you'll see the three layers of pictures, the projection on the back, somebody walking down the hill mid-stage, and then whatever's happening on fourth stage. We just have to be very clever. I mean, in some ways it might lend itself to a more filmic effect anyway. Yes, it remains to be seen.
So presumably you haven't started working towards that yet, because no. October the 1st is the date when this all happens.
Yes.
But will you be involved in doing sort of preliminary takes on it to have run-throughs, which you can then look at and say,
yes,
I'd like the camera moved there.
Yes, there's a camera director on board, because he'll know far more than I will about cameras and filming, and I'll work in conjunction with him. We have 2 days of camera rehearsals with the cast, and then we go out live. So we'll have quite a lot of discussions about it before, during, after the rehearsals.
And it's the last performance, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So going out with a bang. But you, yeah, you'll have the benefit of close-ups, of course, which is one thing we can't have when we're sitting in the audience. Is that something that you're looking forward to?
It is. It really is, actually. It really is. Because if you're interested in psychological truth and therefore you're also interested in some subtext and you're interested in how Bertram might feel, even though he doesn't have a line to tell you.
Yes, his face has got to do an awful lot of the storytelling, hasn't it?
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, exactly. So I'm really excited about that.
Mm. Well, let's go back to Bertram. He's put in, as you say, a situation where a lot of people feel sympathy for him. And yet we do want Helena to win. We can't help wanting Helena to win. And then is all well all's well or not at the end.
Yeah.
It's left wonderfully equivocal, which it has to be for a modern audience. I wonder if that is in the writing, is it? Or do you think that is how we are bound to take the writing?
I think it is in the writing. There's nothing to tell you that it's in the writing, but I can't believe that it's not slightly arbitrary at the end, because everything that leads up to the end is making you ask questions. He absolutely doesn't, Shakespeare doesn't give us a moment where he says, sympathise with Bertram. He doesn't. In the second half, he doesn't do that for Helena. He absolutely doesn't. And he shows you parallels of things happening to other people, like Parolles is a parallel to Bertram. Mm. So he's whatever you might like to call him, but he's quite false and fickle and a man of dishonour, where there's a lot of honour in the play, characters wanting honour and celebrity and fame because they're honourable. And Parolles learns his lesson. Well, I think Bertram learns his lesson at the end, if that's what you want to call it. But I don't think that that's the end of the story. I think that is exactly what Shakespeare's doing, constantly saying, this is the stereotype, this is the usual situation, you know about this, we're absolutely attuned to this moment in the stories that we've been brought up on. But then this happens. So I don't think it is the end of the... end of the line for either of them.
Is it the equivalent of Isabella's silence in the last moments of Measure for Measure?
Yes, it is.
She doesn't say, oh, good, I've been won by somebody I have no idea about, really.
Yes. Mm. I mean, we know very little about Shakespeare. We're not even sure when he wrote All's Well, or even if he wrote it at all, or if he wrote it
or
when he
was
mentally
ill. Or if it was seen on stage until the 18th century.
Yes, exactly. Mm. We know very, very little, really. But what little we were sort of... what little we might know, the academics say that maybe he wrote it when he was about 40, and we also know that his marriage was possibly not hugely happy. So how could he write a play at the age of 40 where somebody gets married and it's all fine, whereas nothing is ever fine in the rest of the play in every single scene? It always has this little twist to it. So that's why I directed it the last moment as I did, because I thought it felt more true to the rest of the play.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there is a lot of lying in the play, isn't there? There's a lot of getting to truth is quite difficult.
There is.
And even Helena's way of winning back her husband, after all, he has agreed to marry her, even though he was under pressure. But she has to pretend to be somebody else and then accept that it's all right for him to be her husband, even though he thinks he's gone to bed with someone he really fancies. It's
it's all very uncomfortable.
Yes.
That's what I love about it. I mean, it's fascinating even now, you know, 2009, how divided people are about the play and how offended people are about different aspects of the play.
Yes.
You know, throughout history, it's gone through all sorts of different slander, I suppose, thrown at it, because for example, in the Victorian times, they didn't really like the play very much because they thought that she was a minx and a vixen to have got her husband into bed with her. Well, they are married, as you say. She had every legal right,
And he set her this ridiculous
he set her
task.
These tasks.
She's got to get herself pregnant by him, even though he doesn't want to sleep with her.
Yeah. And talking to people in the auditorium, you know, who've seen it now in this production, some people are absolutely anti him, completely and utterly, and therefore don't really get it, because they think, well, he's completely abhorrent. Why would she bother? And other people are the opposite. A lot of, say, it doesn't always work out this way, but, you know, a lot of men would say, but he's in absolutely the right to do what he does. And in fact, it's surprising it doesn't go even further.
I think a lot of young men do find it very difficult.
Yeah.
It's interesting, Dr. Johnson really hated him, didn't he?
He did.
He couldn't find a good word to say about him.
No. And yet, you know, even in the rehearsal room, it was quite divided between the men and the women, and the men absolutely thought it was completely fair enough.
That's interesting.
And the women thought he was appalling.
Yes. Doesn't Laurie Maguire say this is the play that shows that women do come from Venus and men from Mars?
Yeah, it does. It really does divide people. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, well. Did you, in the rehearsal room, get people to bring their own experiences? Was that something you did?
No. What you mean about relationships?
About relationships, yeah.
No, I don't think we did. We did really do that. I suppose I had a very clear view of who Helena and Bertram were and why Helena was pursuing him in the first place. You know, she's aiming for something which is a lot higher than her on every single level, and she's incredibly ambitious and she's incredibly noble and brave, yeah,
and single-minded.
To pursue what she does, very yeah. single-minded, yeah. Mm. But it is a fine balance, you know. Watching the show now that we've opened a while, and I'll go back and watch it occasionally, and you think, oh no, we're coming about down a bit too heavy. She's becoming a bit too serious. She's becoming a bit too dominant without any vulnerability, and therefore I'm losing sympathy for her. I'm losing the balance. So it is a constantly sort of a tightrope as to...
It's very difficult balance, isn't it?
It is a difficult balance. But she is actually riddled with insecurities. Yeah. So I think she's a gorgeous creature because she absolutely goes for what she wants, and she's incredibly brave, but it's ultimately hugely insecure.
And it's very crushing to be told by the object of your desire that he's no interest whatsoever in public.
Yeah, and she keeps excusing that as a class thing.
Yes. Which it is partly, isn't it?
Which it is partly, yes. If she could see the whole truth, she'd be much better off.
Yes. Well, one of the delightful things about the play is the way that the women support each other, and there's a lovely relationship between her... the mother-in-law, as she wants her to be, the Countess. And there's that lovely scene where the Countess says she's like a daughter to her, and she doesn't want to be a daughter. She wants to...
Yes.
Because she wants to be married to her son. But still, it's a wonderful take on the wicked stepmother who is a loving stepmother instead.
Yeah.
And then you get those other women in Florence who support her.
Yeah. So isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
The women are completely different. It's almost like they're in a different play.
Mm.
When we first ran it, the whole thing in its entirety in the rehearsal room, we were really struck by the sort of groundedness of the women against the sort of slightly madness of the men. You know, the king's mad, slightly mad, and dying. In fact, there's lots of men who are dying in the play or have
died.
And
they express themselves through war. That's how they feel at their best.
Through war, yes. Mm. They're after this fame, which is slightly innocuous, whereas the women are much more grounded, warm, loving, helping to each other. Yes, it's extraordinary.
And Florence seems a very, very different place, colourful and bright, almost of a different period, really.
It is an art production of a different period, yes.
I thought so.
Yes, it is, absolutely.
Was it specifically, what were you thinking of?
Well, because it's all fairy tale-y, the France scenes are cold and icy and of a period where a fairy tale might be set, you know, a land a long, long way away.
It's a bit of Gormenghast almost in there.
Yes, a bit
of
Gormenghast, exactly, black and white. Nothing too specific, so nothing too real, leaving it in a world of imagination. But then when we go to Florence, it felt like a lot of Shakespeare plays where the characters go somewhere else to let their hair down and don't worry about their identity and then discover more about themselves. You know, like the Forest of Arden or something like that.
Mm.
So they go to Florence, and it felt like it was gay and colourful and holiday romancy and warm, and people were having fun and people were drinking, and you know. So we then set it in a world that was in a vague world again, nothing too realistic, but a vague sort of 50s fun new look.
Right. Yes, well, it's brilliant the way it works. But why do they wear cat suits when they're doing the bed trick?
Well, now...
The bed trick, of course, I'm sure everybody knows, is where the rightful partner is substituted for the one that the man fancies, and therefore no wrong is done, and yet, of course, it is psychologically.
There are a few scenes that are not written that happen off stage in this play, which we decided to stage. Mm. So the wedding of Bertram and Helena, we staged in a tableau. And the bed trick. Again, in the past, people have been quite offended by the bed trick, by the idea that she would trick her husband into bed. And therefore, I actually thought that she's actually a very sexual, lustful character, and we should show. That's incredibly dramatic, that scene. So let's show it somehow.
And she's obviously enjoyed it.
Yes, he has.
And he has
He's
too.
Quite surprised. Yes absolutely. Yeah. So at the end, when he's, you were in bed with me. Right. Again, it sort of complicates it all, which is lovely. The thing that people find quite difficult to believe about the bed trick is, how could he ever go to bed with his wife thinking it was somebody else? Mm. How could that possibly happen? Mm. How could he get his wife pregnant and not realise that he'd done it? Well, we decided that he could, if it was a sort of sexual game, that this girl that he was after set up this sexual game, and in the sexual game she was going to blindfold him so she'd meet him and he would be able to see her and feel her. Then she would blindfold him and he would still feel her and she'd still feel the same way, but she would be a different girl.
Uh-huh.
So we
she
wanted
had to have something he could touch.
Yes,
which was...
and we wanted to set up the sexual game. Yeah. So she got dressed in a something alluring, which is the catsuit, and a bit mad, so he'd go, oh, we're into sexual mad games, okay, well, okay, blindfold, yeah, all right, whatever, rather than her just say, oh, do you mind if I blindfold you?
Yeah.
And she has the same silhouette. Now, also in the production, obviously, there are quite a lot of moments which are picture book moments, which are tableau, black and white tableaus that happen, where you see two-dimensional images in black and white silhouette.
Yes.
And in this moment in the bed trick, you see the silhouette of the catsuit and him arriving, and the silhouette of the blindfold, and then the silhouette of Helena moving in to place while the object of his desire, Diana, leaves.
While at the same time on the stage, we've got the gulling of Parolles
happening. Who's also blindfolded.
Yes, and that's a very nice parallel, isn't it? Because we're making fun of him. Obviously, he's a kind of Falstaffian character in a way, isn't he? But truth and lies are complicating both parts of the stage at the same time.
Yeah.
Underlining each other.
Yes. And Parolles is absolutely what happens to Parolles is absolutely what's going to happen to Bertram. So
yes.
Yeah. So it's nice to have them both on stage at the same time in the same guise.
Yes. Now Helena seems to be able to cope with Parolles rather better than Bertram, who's his best friend, but Helena can keep up with him. She's just as clever and witty and rude, actually, as he is in the early stages.
Yes.
So we're given to understand that she's mentally perhaps ahead of Bertram. She's much cleverer.
Yeah, she's mentally ahead of quite a lot of people, really, because she's mentally ahead of the king, even.
And perhaps even more experienced, not sexually, but in coping with life.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Bertram's account... he's very young. She's possibly the same age. We don't know, but we know that he's very young because people keep referring to his youth.
And you have him playing a sort of adolescent game at the beginning, where he might be killing imaginary monsters, or
that's right. Yes, I wanted to emphasise.
Yes, he would have been a computer nerd, wouldn't he? Playing computer games.
Yeah, he's a pretty boy. He's a count. Probably went to public school. Very spoiled only child. You know, who's always had what he wanted. His experience of life is not Helena's. Who has worked for her father, who was a doctor, whose father died, and then she was taken in by the Countess. She's sort of much more, her brain is much more exercised than his.
Yes. What a shame she doesn't go on being a doctor.
Maybe she does.
Maybe she does,
Maybe
yes.
she does.
Maybe she does. After the marriage falls apart in the next play. She's got a career all lined up. Yeah. I don't suppose it's bothered you at all that people have sometimes said this might be the lost love's labours won.
Yes, people do say that.
Yes,
no.
They do. Yeah,
yeah.
But no. When Bertram comes back, and Helena's been putting it around that she's dead, which again is another lie which she indulges in.
Mm.
Is that just to give her a bit more, give her an advantage, or is it another test for him? I mean. Because he goes straight back to court and begins setting up another marriage, doesn't he? Which
yes, I think it is a complete test for everybody, actually. Mm-hmm. I think it is a test. I think it's like the last line of the play that the king says, where he sort of explains that the more difficult the present, the more shining the future will be. Mm-hmm. So she makes things as bad as they can possibly be for Bertram. so that when she emerges, she actually saves his skin, because the king would probably have him executed. They're all absolutely anti and against him and think that he's killed her.
Yeah.
Suddenly she turns up and rectifies every single wrong against him.
Yes.
So suddenly she's like this angel that takes all the grief away from everybody in that long scene, which takes 20 minutes, that last scene.
Yeah.
And she turns up at the last five, well, less than that, the last 2 minutes she turns up.
Yes, and we have the advantage of seeing her coming, which is lovely.
Yeah.
Down the long walk,
yes,
in the distance.
So how could he refuse her now?
Yes. But I felt a bit sorry for Lefou's daughter, who's...
She doesn't look too happy, though, did she? She didn't look too happy to marry Bertram.
To be married,
either.
No.
She wanted to carry on with her knitting, I think.
And then the king hasn't learned anything at all, because he says, oh, now I'm going
exactly,
to...
Exactly.
And let's have another competition.
Yeah.
So, lovely to talk to you, and thank you very much. And good luck with NT Live.
Pleasure.